Hello, ahlan wa sahlan. Welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1089, we will listen to the eyewitness account of Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, world-renowned Palestinian-British surgeon, who spent over 44 days in Gaza treating patients while Israel was attacking the Gaza Strip. Dr. Abu Sitta was at Al Ahli Hospital when it was attacked by Israel. We will also listen to Tayyib Ali, director of ICJP, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, outlining the criminal allegations under investigation and what the evidence ICJP is collecting regarding the Israeli attack on Gaza. And on the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, observed on November 29th of every year, I will air the remarks of Professor Tsepochiri, Assistant Professor of African History at the University of Houston, delivered at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October at U of H and organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. Despite the current ceasefire, the situation in the Gaza Strip continues to worsen every day with the extreme lack of basic food supplies, medicine, water, electricity, and other critical needs. Yes, there have been some supplies entering the Gaza Strip as part of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, but it is not enough for the 2.3 million Palestinians who live there. Most of them now are staying in shelters because their homes were bombed and destroyed by apartheid Israel. As part of the ceasefire agreement, started for 4 days, then renewed for 2 more, and is being discussed daily for almost daily renewals, prisoner swaps are part of the deal between Israel and Hamas through the Red Cross. What is worth noting here are the stories told by dozens of Palestinians who were released by Israel through the prisoner swap, speaking of horrific treatments from both men and women, and most of them, by the way, were children. Some said they were threatened with rape and that the Israelis would burn their children. One female reported threats of sexual assault in an Israeli prison during an interview with Al Jazeera, and others were speaking of horrific attacks against them, breaking their bones, assaulting them, and beating them. ICJP, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians in the United Kingdom, an independent organization of lawyers, academics, and politicians that work to promote and support Palestinian rights, held a press conference on November 27, 2023, at which Tayyib Ali, the director of ICJP, outlined the criminal allegations under investigation and what the evidence ICJP is collecting regarding the Israeli attack on Gaza. At that same press conference, Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, world-renowned Palestinian-British surgeon who spent 45 days in Gaza treating patients while Israel was attacking the Gaza Strip, gave his testimony and eyewitness account describing the Israeli aggression through the types of injuries received at Gaza hospitals. Let's listen in to the remarks delivered at that press conference by Tayyib Ali and Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta.
Since the atrocious and heinous acts on 7th of October, Israel has been conducting a widespread and unprecedented bombing campaign in Gaza, resulting in colossal civilian death toll. Since the 7th of October, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, Israel has killed at least 14,800 people in Gaza, including at least 6,000 children, and another 36,000 Palestinians have reportedly been injured. Thousands of Palestinians, including many children, remain trapped under the rubble. More women and children have been reported killed in Gaza in less than 2 months than roughly 7,700 civilians documented as killed by US forces and their international allies in the entire first year of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. These are according to estimates from the Iraq Body Count, an independent British research group. It's alleged that Israel has targeted and destroyed civilian objects, including homes, schools, hospitals, refugee camps, ambulances, churches, and mosques. Reports estimate that Israel has destroyed or damaged over 45% of Gaza's residential housing units. It has bombed and destroyed life-sustaining infrastructure, including water and sanitation facilities, food factories and bakeries. Since October the 8th, Israel accepts it has imposed a total siege on Gaza, cutting off Gaza's electricity and water supplies, and preventing access of fuel, food, water, and other humanitarian aid necessary for the survival of the population, including medicine and medical supplies. Israel has been accused of manufacturing a humanitarian catastrophe on top of an illegal 16-year-long blockade, which even Lord David Cameron referred to in 2011 as a prison camp. The total siege has led to numerous deaths, often of the most vulnerable people, such as patients in intensive care, premature babies, as well as horrific stories of doctors having to perform surgery without anesthesia, including on children. It has also led to widespread hunger, starvation, and the spread of preventable diseases. Since the 13th of October, Israel has been ordering and pressuring people in northern Gaza to leave their homes and move south. Over 1.7 million people in Gaza, over 80% of the population, have now been internally displaced, in what UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini has described the largest displacement of Palestinians since 1948. ICJP does not condone or accept violations of international law by any party, whether the perpetrator is Palestinian or Israeli. Any party that violates international law in the context of Israel and Gaza should be investigated and brought before a fair tribunal to account for the allegations made against them. Shortly after it appeared that Israel was prepared to collectively punish all Palestinians in an apparent punitive response to the heinous actions that took place on October the 7th, the ICJP launched its Justice for Gaza campaign. This was done in the context of Western political leaders at best recklessly or at worst purposefully misrepresenting international law to the point that they became in danger of being complicit in potential Israeli war crimes. Early action taken by the ICJP was to remind politicians of their obligations under international law and to put politicians on notice that we would seek prosecutions for those that encouraged or supported war crimes. Since then, ICJP has constituted a war crimes investigation unit in relation to the events in Gaza. The investigation unit is collating first-hand evidence on the ground in Gaza, as well as taking witness testimony and expert evidence in relation to the attack on Gaza. ICJP will seek accountability for any violation of international law, no matter who it is perpetrated by. We work with skilled investigators and will prepare evidence of Israeli actions in Gaza to a British criminal legal standard. Where we find evidence of violations of international humanitarian law, we intend to hold the perpetrators accountable in the UK, at the International Criminal Court, and any other jurisdiction in the world that is prepared to hold those that violate international law to account. We are building case files on specific suspects. These include, but are not limited to, Israeli political and military personnel. We are also investigating politicians and commentators inside and outside of Israel where there is evidence that they may have violated Article 25 of the Rome Statute by aiding, abetting, or in any other way supporting, including the encouragement of the commission of war crimes. We are also investigating the involvement of British citizens that have traveled to Israel to participate in military action with the IDF or other Israeli forces. Where there is evidence that British citizens have participated in war crimes in Israel or Gaza, we intend to provide that evidence to the International Criminal Court and law enforcement agencies as appropriate. We intend, as we have done in previous cases, to work with Scotland Yard's War Crimes Unit. To that end, Professor Ghassan will be providing his first-hand witness testimony and expert evidence to Scotland Yard in the coming days. Following our interview with a number of witnesses who have recently returned from Gaza, we have started to build a first-hand picture of Israel's actions in Gaza. We have collated evidence to support allegations of the widespread commission of war crimes by Israel. The criminal offences we are investigating are under international humanitarian law and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. These are not limited to, but include, willful killing, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, extensive destruction of property, collective punishment, unlawful deportation or transfer, intentionally directing attacks against the civilian population or civilian objects, and using starvation of civilians as a method of warfare. We are actively investigating Israel's alleged commission of crimes against humanity. These are crimes which are committed as part of a widespread and systematic attack against the civilian population. The ICJP is also investigating the criminal offence of genocide. There's already a clear risk that Israel may be committing the acts of genocide in Gaza. We have therefore asked governments to trigger their obligations under the Genocide Convention to prevent this potential genocide. Unfortunately, there is now credible and growing evidence that Israel is attempting to commit, if not actively committing, the crime of genocide against the Palestinian population of Gaza. The legal definition of genocide refers to specific actions taken with the intention of destroying in whole or in part the group targeted on ethnic, racial, religious, or national grounds. Such actions can include killing, causing serious bodily or mental harm, or deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of the group in whole or in part. Now, it's often difficult to prove intent on the part of the perpetrator when investigating the crime of genocide. We have, however, accumulated significant evidence in relation to Israel's intention in relation to Gaza. Senior members of Israel's government, so used to impunity for their actions, are not hiding the evidence of their intent in relation to their military operation in Gaza. I just want to expand on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's declaration on 29th of October 2023, when he invoked religious scripture and referred to Amalek. And I just want to explain what that means in the context of religious scripture. The Bible states, and I'm just going to simply read the quote and not add any interpretation to it. It's accepted that Benjamin Netanyahu did not go on to expand on his quote, but used the reference of Amalek alone. But the quote, "Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." And that's the quote. That quote gives a context to the reference that he made on the 26th of October. And in our view, is evidence of intent with relation to the attack on Gaza. Before I introduce Professor Ghassan to you, I'm going to just refer to some of the testimony, so just outline some of the testimony that we've taken in the last few days. And I'm going to make clear that the testimony that we've taken in our scoping and investigative exercise will all be passed on to law enforcement agencies, including Scotland Yard, the International Criminal Court, and other law enforcement agencies around the world. In addition to that, the ICJP will use the principles of universal jurisdiction to directly apply for arrest warrants and prosecution of individuals that we consider have a prima facie case of war crimes against them. Our witnesses are providers of some harrowing and disturbing testimony, which we'll be making available to you as well if you require it. We have heard firsthand evidence in our investigation of Israeli forces directly and deliberately targeting civilians by bombing them in their homes in circumstances where it was likely known that dozens of innocent people may be killed, including children. Our witnesses have reported the deliberate targeting of rescue workers, journalists, and healthcare staff. Our witnesses spoke of the deliberate targeting of civilian objects, including hospitals, UN schools, ambulances, and places of worship. We have video and witness testimony of the bombing of an entire residential block, killing everyone inside. Our witnesses reported the wiping out of entire families, every generation from babies to grandmothers. Some of our witnesses were present at these events and described them as massacres. Our witnesses provided testimony that the Israeli army has telephoned people in their homes in the north and ordered them to leave, otherwise they would be killed in an impending attack. In some cases, the homes have indeed been attacked and destroyed. In other cases, we have heard people were told their houses would be bombed and ordered to be immediately evacuated, but the houses were not in fact attacked. Witnesses have spoken about the random nature of these threats, which they think are deliberate and aimed at and did cause fear and terror among civilians. We have heard that Israel has been targeting people with no links to Hamas or other armed groups. We have heard of cases of Fatah officials being targeted and being killed along with their families, people who not only have no links to Hamas but are expressly opposed to them. We have heard of other cases where areas that people have fled to because they are seen as safe areas being targeted and bombed for no apparent reason. We've also heard testimony of people being attacked when they've gone to help other civilians trapped under rubble in the immediate aftermath of Israeli bombings in civilian homes. We have heard accounts of civilians being targeted as they're fleeing, often while escaping on designated safe routes, sometimes by aerial bombing, sometimes by snipers. We have heard testimony of quadcopters and snipers being used to target civilians that are visiting or trying to visit hospitals. You'll hear from Professor Ghassan how he treated a 9-year-old child shot by a quadcopter. We continue to collect testimony that senior hospital officials receive phone calls to evacuate hospitals or face them being attacked. You again will hear from Professor Ghassan in this regard. We continue to collect significant video and photographic footage from Gaza. We intend to provide our footage to expert witnesses for analysis as part of our investigation. And at ICGP, we call on any eyewitnesses of any of the actions taken by Israel in Gaza to provide us with evidence. But more importantly than that, we also ask people in the IDF that have evidence of Israeli atrocities or Israeli war crimes to contact us at the ICGP and provide us with direct evidence of the command control structure and the orders that were given and the information that we think would be really important in terms of establishing whether in fact Israel did or did not intend to target civilians, the orders in respect to how to safeguard civilian infrastructures, objects, and people in that area. So I'd like to now introduce Professor Ghassan. Professor Ghassan Abu Sitta is a multi-award-winning plastic and reconstructive surgeon with a reputation as one of the world's leading specialists in craniofacial surgery, facial aesthetics, cleft lip and palate surgery, and trauma-related injuries. His unique background combines the skills and expertise of a field-leading plastic surgeon with the rigors of academia and the compassion of a humanitarianist. Professor Abu Sitta's pioneering research and innovation have transformed the faces and lives of his patients across the globe. As a recognized authority in his field, he has featured regularly in the press and has been dubbed the man who fixes broken faces. Ghassan has over 30 years experience, having worked in 12 wars across Yemen, Iraq, Syria, South Lebanon, and Gaza. For the past year, he has run the plastic surgery residency program run by a Palestinian medical aid charity. He set up the curriculum and coordinated the rota for the program. He has also written two textbooks on war surgery and is widely regarded as an expert in war-related surgery. Professor Ghassan.
Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to basically first pay tribute to my colleagues who have been killed in Gaza. Over 160 Palestinian doctors and nurses and paramedics. Pay tribute and call on the medical establishment to advocate for the immediate release of over 10 doctors who have been arrested openly or have been disappeared. And to start with, I arrived in the Gaza Strip on Monday, the 9th of October, in the early hours of the morning. And that was a decision that I made on the night of the 7th of October, having realized that Gaza was about to face a extremely brutal and vicious attack. I reached out to my contacts at MSF, who arranged for me to travel to Cairo on Sunday and then make it across the Sinai Desert in a car to get into Gaza, with the feeling that usually in these conflicts, there's a small window at the very beginning that you can use to get in. On arrival to the Gaza Strip, I went to a family house, but within half an hour, the whole neighborhood had been telephoned by the Israeli army and informed that particularly the tower blocks behind the house that I was in were going to be targeted by the Israeli Air Force. Almost the whole neighborhood was in the street trying to run away. I then moved to another house, and we were pinned down that night because of the severe bombing. In the early hours of Tuesday morning, when there was a lull in the fighting, I managed to go back to the damaged building that I had evacuated and pick up my suitcase and then walk to Shifa Hospital from there. And from there on, I joined the plastic and reconstructive surgery team at the Burns unit at Shifa Hospital. During my time at Shifa Hospital, it became apparent that 40 to 45% of all the wounded were going to be children. That there were the primary target of the bombing was people's residential homes, and that we were getting multi-generational patients from the same families in each air raid. Most of the injuries initially were blast injuries, and these were severe soft tissue traumas, severe facial traumas, multiple fractures. And then, as time went, we saw the introduction of incendiary bombs, where the patients would have over 40% of their total body surface area burnt with no other injuries. And by the time Shifa had collapsed, there were over 100 of these patients at Shifa Hospital. And we started seeing phosphorus burns. I had treated white phosphorus burns in the Gaza Strip during the 2009 war and was very familiar with the very characteristic injuries and burns that they make. As a chemical burn, phosphorus burns burn right through to the inner core of the body and only stop when they have no exposure to oxygen. And so the burns would be, the patient would be basically puckered with burns that core right into the ribs, the bones, and unlike thermal burns that spread from the surface more horizontally. We also started to notice the increased use of fragmentary missiles. Patients were coming in with very unique injury patterns. In normal blast injuries, the wound edge is covered with soot and is burnt, and there's a lot of rubble, dirt, clothes, metal inside the wound. These wounds were very clean cut. Unlike blast injuries where the amputation happens at the weakest part of the body, like the joints, these patients were having guillotine amputations in extremely tough parts of the body, in the mid-thigh, where you have to work your way through all of the muscles of the thigh and the thigh bone, the femur. And they had serrated edges, as if what they had been hit by was a saw. Really, by day four, day five, half of my operating list, which was around 10 to 12 cases every day, starting at 8 or 9 in the morning and finishing at 1 in the morning, were children. My estimate is that there are now between 700 and 900 children with amputations of limbs, in some of whom multiple limbs have been amputated. On one night, at Al Ahli Hospital, I performed amputations on 6 children. At one stage, when there was a call from one of the plastic surgery teams further up north at Al Awda Hospital, which is an NGO hospital where MSF has a base and a unit there, in Jabalia camp, I moved to Al Awda Hospital from Shifa. On the third day that I was there, and in front of me, I witnessed a phone call by the Israeli army to the medical director of the hospital. And he was informed that unless he evacuates the hospital within 2 hours, the hospital was going to be targeted. Of course, that was not going to be possible. First of all, the job of the hospital is only to leave once all of the population is left. And two, that there were many patients that were too difficult to move. We evacuated the patients that had been operated on, were recovering from their injuries, and I moved back to Shifa to rejoin the plastic surgery team there. While in Shifa, the number of burns and the number of pediatric injuries were increased. One of the most horrific scenes that I witnessed in Shifa Hospital was when, after the air raid and the dead and the wounded were brought in, members of the Shifa medical staff and nursing staff would be running frantically in the emergency department, looking at the faces of the wounded and the dead, to see whether their relatives had been amongst the wounded, and in many cases their children had been amongst the dead and the wounded. At one point, one of our colleagues, Dr. Midhat Saydam, while at work, his sister came with her children because they had been forced to evacuate their home. He decided to just take them to his house where his other siblings were taking refuge. And a few hours later, he was killed along with all of his siblings and their children. His children and his wife were buried under the rubble and were only saved 24 hours later. Dr. Midhat Saydam became one of many doctors that were killed, and we discovered after I came back and after the ceasefire that another member of the plastic surgery team, a nurse working at the burns unit, was also killed with his brother when their house was targeted. At one point, the discussion was with Ahli Hospital, because of the overwhelming pressure on beds at Shifa. We had over 2,000 wounded in a hospital that had a bed capacity of 600. The decision was that I would move to Al-Ahli Hospital, which we felt was safe because Al-Ahli Hospital, as you all know, is owned and run by the World Council of Churches and managed by the Church of England here. On the morning of the massacre at Al-Ahli Hospital, I moved by ambulance from Shifa Hospital to Al-Ahli. Al-Ahli is the oldest hospital in Gaza. It had at some stage been called the English Hospital because it was housed, and it was the hospital in which British soldiers during the First World War were treated. And it was full of plaques that families of British soldiers had dedicated to their loved ones. When we walked in to the hospital, I could notice that what had been happening in Shifa was happening at Al-Ahli Hospital. The hospital was turning into an internally displaced camp. There were lots of children and families in the grounds of Al-Ahli Hospital. I went, I saw the patients, made a decision whom to operate on, made a list of 10 patients that needed surgery that day and another 10 that needed surgery the following day. And around 12 o'clock that morning, we had a visit from the CEO of the hospital and the medical director, Dr. Maher Ayad. What had happened in the days before is that also Dr. Maher Ayad had received a phone call from the Israeli army ordering him to evacuate the hospital. A day later, when he didn't, Israeli drones fired two missiles at the fence of the hospital. And then he had received a second phone call from the same officer berating him for not having evacuated and telling him that unless he evacuated, the hospital was going to be hit. The reason why we had the visit from the management team is that they told us they had been in touch with the bishop in London and that he had received reassurances that we could carry on our work. By 5 o'clock, I had made this decision that I needed to operate into the night and start early in the morning. And upon discussion, we made a decision that I would stay over and continue working at Al-Ahli. Later on that evening, between having wheeled out one of the patients and we were about to bring the next patient in, and there had been in the few hours before a lot of bombing around the hospital and you could kind of feel it shake. There was an almighty whistling sound coming towards us, kind of indicative of a missile, and then a huge explosion. It was obvious from the size of the explosion and the damage that it was either at the edge of the hospital or within the hospital. The false ceiling in the operating room fell on top of us. Luckily, I wasn't injured, and I walked out of the operating room into a corridor that you could see the forecourt of the hospital in, where the families had seen the families earlier on. The ambulances were on fire. Some of the cars were on fire, and the forecourt, which had been lit by that fire, was full of bodies. and parts of bodies. I made my way through, and you saw some of the video there. That's a video that I took at Al Ahli, through the survivors trying to get to the other end of the hospital. I went to the emergency department. The first patient that I saw on my right was a man in his mid-50s with an amputation at the level of the mid-thigh, similar to those guillotine amputations that I was telling you about. And there was blood spurting through the exposed arteries in his stump. I took his belt and tied it as a tourniquet, and then set about trying to find someone's shirt to take it and tie it as a second tourniquet, and try to resuscitate him. Once I was satisfied that he had been stabilized, I moved on to another patient who had received a single shrapnel to his neck, and that shrapnel had hit one of the vessels in his neck and blood was spurting out of the neck. I put my hand on the wound to try to stop the bleeding and found someone else to put their hand and started resuscitating that patient. While I was resuscitating the patient, the ambulance staff started to arrive, and I had a tap on my shoulder, looked behind, and there was a stretcher with some paramedics. We moved him to the stretcher. I kept my hand on his neck so that we'd stop the bleeding and helped carry him outside. And we walked out into the forecourt to try to get to the ambulances. And that's when I saw the full extent of the carnage in the forecourt. Not only were there lots of dead bodies, but there were also parts of bodies. And I remember walking past the amputated forearm of a child. I took him to the ambulance. I then went with him to Shifa Hospital, and that's when the rest of the wounded came from Shifa, from Al Ahli to Shifa as they were brought in. And then when we had triaged and stabilized the patients and sent them up to the operating room, I went in and rejoined the burns unit at Shifa Hospital. For the following few days, I just rejoined the team at Shifa Hospital, and we were seeing more and more children, more and more burns, but we were also seeing a phenomena at Shifa, which by the time Shifa had been completely surrounded by the Israelis, there were 120 children at Shifa Hospital who were wounded children with no surviving families. Some of whom were too young for us to even know their names. These had been taken out of the rubble and there was no one left to care for them. There were over 100 major burns, and the bed crisis at Shifa had reached to the point where the wounded were being looked after on mattresses in the floors of the corridors, in the floors of the wards, in the emergency department. I stayed at Shifa for a while, for a few days, until the team at Al Ahli Hospital was able to fix two of the operating rooms and reopen the ground floor so that at least Al Ahli could be partially functioning again. Because of the pressures on Shifa, where we were less and less able to operate on patients because of lack of medication, lack of consumables, lack of anesthetic, I decided to go back to Al Ahli, but on a shuttle basis. I would take 5 or 6 patients from Shifa Hospital to Al Ahli Hospital, operate on them there, and then initially first day come back to Al Ahli and join the team at the end of that working day and operate, and then go in the morning back to Al Ahli and take some more cases. That continued until one morning I was in the ambulance trying to go to Shifa, because I had promised a colleague whose son had a severe facial injury that I would operate on his son at Shifa. And when we were in the ambulance, I could see at the end of the road, Israeli APCs crossing across the street that we were in. And we turned around and came back. That night, we had an influx of patients whose families managed to get them out of Shifa Hospital before it was completely surrounded. But also, we became the only functioning hospital in the whole of Gaza City. And with the exception of the Indonesian hospital, the only functioning hospital in the northern part of Gaza. We started then receiving direct injuries to Al-Ahli Hospital. And the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which manages the ambulance service in the Gaza Strip, set up a trauma stabilization field hospital inside the grounds of Al-Ahli Hospital. For that period afterwards, we started seeing more and more of these fragmentary missiles. But we also started seeing, and for the first time since I was in Gaza, people with patients with high velocity sniper injuries. And we could hear the distinctive noise that the quadcopter makes, followed by a single shot. On one day, we received 20 patients. There was a mother and child. There were some brought in dead from the quadcopters. And we discovered that these quadcopters had been released in the roads that were leading up to Al-Ahli Hospital. These wounded were trying to come to Al-Ahli to see family or for medical emergencies rather than for wound emergencies, because by that time, all of the hospitals in Gaza, including the pediatric hospitals, had been completely neutralized and put out of service. These injuries are very distinctive because the size of the inlet wound to the outlet wound is disproportionate. The inlet wound is a very small stellate-shaped wound, and the outlet wound, where that high-velocity, high-energy bullet comes out, is bigger than a clenched fist. I remained at Al-Ahli Hospital, but witnessed the dwindling of the supplies, and some of the patients, especially the little girl whose leg was covered in shrapnel that you saw, we started having to perform extremely painful procedures, including on that nine-year-old girl, without anesthetic. Patients were starting to develop wound infections, and at a minimum, we needed to clean the wounds so that we can hopefully, once things stabilize, operate on them. The final straw came when a mosque in Sabra neighborhood was targeted. 60 people had been brought in dead, and hundreds were wounded. That night, we operated into early hours of the following morning, around 5 o'clock, I was informed by my colleagues that we had run out of anesthetic and that the operating rooms would no longer be able to look after patients. That's when I made the decision to go to the south, because I had felt that as a surgeon with no access to operating rooms, no access to morphine, no access to ketamine, which is a kind of veterinary anesthetic that we used to use on patients, there was nothing for me to do. And that was day 40 of my stay in Gaza. We set out that morning, a group of us, myself, a colleague who's the anesthetist, and a couple of the nursing staff who had family in the south, and we walked for over 5 hours through what looked like a scene from a dystopian film. There were bodies everywhere. There was the sound of Israeli tanks as they were encircling and moving into position around Al-Ahli Hospital. And there was just absolute destruction. The pinnacle of that journey comes to a bottleneck that the Israelis have created in Salah al-Din Street, which connects the north and the south, where you almost walk in a clearing or a corridor that they had made that is half the width of this room. And you, on your left, are Israeli snipers and soldiers with cameras, and you're asked to, while you're walking, to look at these cameras. And my feeling was that it's because so that the facial recognition software can find out who you are. And then you, the soldier would ask people to stop, and then they would say something like, "The man in the red coat, there's someone next to you, to your right, put your hand on their shoulder." And you do that, and then they say, "You, that man, leave the kid that you are carrying behind and come over here." And you could see at the very end of that left side, there were over 15 Palestinians stripped naked, blindfolded, and on their knees with their hands tied behind their backs that they had arrested and picked up from that road. I arrived at Nusayrat camp and joined another hospital in Nusayrat camp, but quickly realized that the crisis in consumables, in medication, in these hospitals meant that a lot of the surgeons were unable to take their patients to the operating room. And for 2 days that I was in Sirat before I left, I was just doing changes of dressing because there was no ability to operate on these kids. That's when I made the decision to leave the Gaza Strip. And the following day, my name came out on the list that, at Rafah border, and I left through Rafah on day 43. Since I've left, we've discovered lots of colleagues had been killed and taken out of the rubble. Since I've left, the Israelis have bombed Al-Awda, the hospital, killing 3 doctors and narrowly killing a 4th. And the whole of the northern Gaza Strip still has no hospitals functioning in it. Thank you.
What you just heard was the testimony of Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, world-renowned Palestinian British surgeon who spent over 40 days in Gaza, speaking at a press conference held in the UK on November 27, 2023. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. November 29th of each year is observed worldwide as the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. And in support of that, I will air now the remarks of Professor Tsepo Chiri, Assistant Professor of African History at the University of Houston, delivered at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at and organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. Let's listen in. The voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Abdelrazak Takriti, Associate Professor and Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History, and the founding director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston.
This is the situation we're living in. So as we reflect on that, we should remember that this has happened before. And we have here a very distinguished scholar of a process and a land that is very dear to every Palestinian. A struggle that we've often identified as a sister struggle, the South African struggle. There's a sense of deep comradeship in the same way that this colonial affect is manifested itself in this almost automatic solidarity and identification between different and settler populations. We have a different kind of affect going on. Those that went through settler colonization recognize each other's wounds. And that's why I'm very honored that Professor Tsepo Chiri came with us today. It's not easy to come and speak on this topic. You'll get pressure. And she has received pressure. But you know what? She's strong as hell, and she comes from a deep and proud tradition of both knowledge and political activism. So it's a great honor to introduce you, Professor Terry. She teaches South African history here at the University of
Amanda, go ahead to power to the people. I stand on Texas soil, but my heart is in Palestine. I stand on Texas soil, but my people in Johannesburg and Cape Town, they send their love to the Palestinian people. I send my love to those of you who have lost people. We have lost people with you. We watch, we're horrified, we're stunned. We can't believe that we are seeing the same thing again and again and again. And our hearts break. They break with the weight of seeing politics played out on children. Our hearts break because the land is stolen. Our hearts break because humanity is not recognized. Our hearts break because history is not being spoken. So I'm going to start with Baldwin. We have not stopped trembling yet. But if we had not loved each other, none of us would have survived. And now you must survive because we love you. And for the sake of your children and your children's children, you're going to survive. Start with Baldwin because that's where my heart is. I start with Baldwin because I understand that my freedom is not complete without the total liberation of all people, without the total liberation of the Palestinian people. My country got free in 1994. We lived under apartheid, which was a racial hierarchy that put Europeans on the top and then tried to divide all these people of color into these sections and these spaces. We had to live in different communities. We had to have subpar schooling. But mainly what I want to talk about today is that our land was taken away. And what I want to talk about today is that we haven't achieved liberation. And what I want to talk about today is, as the world stood horrified in 1976, when the South African government shot South African children, and then it started seemingly, right, an international movement of solidarity against apartheid that took decades on decades to gain. We don't see the same thing with Palestine. We don't see that cross-international moment of solidarity. And so that's part of why I want to make it unequivocally clear that I stand with the Palestinian people, because we've got to start lining up. We've got to start saying what actually is happening. We have to actually seriously say that there is some systematic oppression taking place. As it stands, most of us are focused on the terror and the violence that we see in the Western media circuits. But we have to understand that there is another side to this, that there is a side that's underreported, that's not understood, that's underhistoricized. I'm a historian, if you can imagine that, given what I've said so far. But I won't touch the historical so deeply because I think it has been touched already. So you guys have eviscerated my notes. It's okay. But I do want to say that under apartheid, the only way that we at least politically gained freedom was because we started. Well, we had been, you know, calling out the alarm for a long time, but we were talking in rooms like this. We were distributing pamphlets, as much information as we could get out about what was happening on the ground. We tried to get out as many people that could walk around and say something on a university campus, in a community, whether it was in UK, the US, elsewhere. That's what we were doing. So what I want you to know is we have space. This is our space. right? So we leave this room and we're not going to be scattered. Hold the space. Hold the space. Like the knowledge that we're talking about here, it's not just meant for pontification. Hold the space when you're out in the streets. Tell the story, give the conditions on the ground, talk about what's happening, understand white settler colonialism, and at least attempt to have people begin to understand. Unfortunately, it's a process of trying to bring people along, right? We're trying to bring people along so that they can even begin to understand. Why don't people understand? Because they don't humanize the Palestinian people. Why don't people understand? Because we're not talking enough. We're not making enough sound, enough noise. Hold the space. Don't concede ground. So I'm not going to give myself too much time here, but I do want to read from a Palestinian mother. And I picked a mother because I'm a mother and I think about the kids. She says, today in Gaza, I no longer believe we'll get out of Israel's assault alive. On Wednesday, I woke up from my sporadic sleep to the sound of the bombardment that continued nonstop for the past 4 nights. Each night we wake up in a different house, but each day the sounds and the smells we wake up to are the same. Our house was badly damaged on the first night of the bombardment. We moved to my parents' home. Then on Tuesday, a missile strike that destroyed a home just one building away left my parents' home uninhabitable. So we came to the home of my in-laws. Now there are 40 of us here. There are 40 of us here. There are 40 of us here. It feels as though the missiles are following us, getting closer with each strike, and we are running out of places to run to, which is why we hold the space. I prayed the pre-sunrise prayer and then lay down beside my two-month-old son as he slept. I couldn't smell his skin, his hair, through the stench of gunpowder, smoke, and the dust that seems to permanently fill the air. It was just minutes later and the windows blew in, covering us with shards of glass. I instinctively covered his tiny body with my own. Then I grabbed him and ran, all the while crying out for my 8-year-old daughter. My husband and I took turns hugging her when we found her. We tried to give her comfort as best we could, knowing that there was so little comfort to be found. Still shaken, we ran downstairs to the ground floor so we could leave if needed, but then the bombardment appeared to stop. Outside, the air attacks had leveled yet another home, just meters from where we were. Thankfully, the people who lived there were not inside when it struck. When we were still at my parents' home, we similarly ran downstairs and shouted cries to the neighbors, warning each other to take cover. I held my baby tightly and turned his face towards my chest as though I could shield him from the dust and the fumes from the explosives. I thought my parents' home would be safe. I thought my in-laws' place would be safe. But where do we go next? There is not a home in Gaza that is safe. Senzenina. Song says, what can we do? Can do everything. Got lights, got water. Got air. Hold the space.
Thank you, Professor Sherry, for these very, very powerful words. I know they're coming both from the heart, but also from a deep intellectual understanding of this process. Professor Sherry, by the way, is a fantastic scholar of the South African liberation struggle, and she has a book that is just appearing now. I really recommend it, Kingdom Come. It's about faith and liberation. So I highly recommend that you check it out if you want to learn about South Africa. But there's so much connections out there. And certainly the Palestinian-South African one is a very deep one. Always has been, always will be.
Professor Sepo Chiri, Assistant Professor of African History at the University of Houston, speaking at the Emergency Palestine Teach-In held in October 2023 at the University of Houston, organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn